Hello and welcome to Horrible Friends. It's a podcast and book club format about horror movies. And this week we have Jacob's Ladder, the 1990 version. Please don't do the 2019 version. Starting off, my name is Kyle.
I'm Chris.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Jarvis.
And the way this is going to work is we are going to give you a little bit of the history of this movie. We're going to tell you about the movie with a little synopsis. And then we're going to tell you about the way we feel about this movie and probably the piercing that goes along with this. So starting off, Dan, what kind of history we got for this one?
So Jacob's Ladder, 2019, right? 2019. That's what we said.
Oh, please God, no.
All right. Fine. 1990 then. What
a miserable experience that one was.
We'll go to 1990 then. This was directed by Adrian Lynn. Adrian Lynn's known for doing movies like Fatal Attraction, Lolita, and Flashdance.
Huh.
Yeah, no, I didn't expect that. Between Flashdance and
Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever seen Fatal Attraction?
Yes.
Isn't that Jamie Lee Curtis?
No, it's Michelle Pfeiffer, I think.
Someone gets all sexy.
No, it's not
in that
Michelle
one.
Pfeiffer. No.
Glenn Close?
Well, that's
Glenn Close.
She's the other woman, but she becomes obsessed, right?
Yeah, and then she burns that. She burns the bunny. She boils it alive.
Is that a horror movie? We may have to have a discussion about that one.
It's kind of like a thriller.
Yeah.
It edges. It goons.
We do love a good edge here on horror.
We do
films.
Like a good edge.
Well, if you didn't expect that, then let's see if you expected this. The screenplay for this was done by Bruce Joel Rubin, who's known for doing movies such as Ghost. Oh, I love Ghost. Deep Impact and Stuart Little, too.
Oh, wow.
Naturally. Naturally.
That is the, you know, trajectory as a writer. It all leads to Stuart Little, too.
Wait, who did the first one? We talked about Stuart Little.
We've talked about it before.
We've talked about it at great lengths, yeah.
Wasn't that during Slither? Wasn't that when we talked about Stuart Little?
We did a little bit, but Shyamalan wrote Stuart Little, the screenplay.
Yes, that's right.
We talked about James Gunn writing Scooby-Doo.
Yes.
So other 1990 horror movies that we could have watched. It was a fun year for horror movies, and I say that in a non-sarcastic way. We have movies like Misery, we have Tremors, we have Arachnophobia, we have Night of the Living Dead, we have the It television series, and of course, who could forget Frankenhooker?
Nice.
So it was just great year.
We haven't watched that one yet because
I think it's because we're selfish, Kyle.
Ah.
We're going to make him goon a little longer.
The runtime for this is around an hour and 53 minutes.
I feel like this is the longest movie we've watched in a little while.
And yet, so like the length is definitely noticeable, but I...
That's what she said.
Trust me, she did. But I actually did enjoy this watch. So
yeah, like it wasn't a painful like nearly 2 hours.
Right.
Not the whole thing.
No, yeah, just the parts where the piercings first went in, then it's a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, that part's painful.
I jumped probably 20 minutes in. I started like jumping around a little bit until something interesting. I don't know. There are pieces of this that were a little bit slower than needed to be, but at the same time, it wasn't a bad build. It wasn't terrible. It was not definitely by far not the worst movie we've seen.
I'd say by the second half, it built up to something where I was interested. The first half, I was kind of just like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, and honestly, here's a pro tip: 1.5 speed, totally fine. There was no.
Yeah, but that's your that's your life philosophy when it comes to movies. Like everything from this to Stuart Little 2, you're gonna watch at 1.5 speed.
I actually don't like doing it. I get forced to do it because I'm an asshole. But I do.
Who's forcing you?
Me.
Oh, okay. I'm a serial procrastinator. Asshole.
Yes, I'm a serial procrastinator, and that's just what happens. But I will say this one, there were I think it got better at 1.5 speed. It was a little bit slower. Nothing seemed odd. It was kind of a slow, talker. I don't know, man.
I have a feeling that when Kyle has kids, he's going to be like, all right, we're going to watch The Grinch 1.5 speed.
And you know what? They'll never know any difference.
They won't.
They'll only know it at 1.5.
They're going to get older and watch it again and be like,
this shit's so slow.
No, dude, they're going to go to a friend's house and they're going to be like, what the fuck is wrong with your television? Why is everything so perpetually fucking slow?
And some say that the Grinches are rude, three
too slow.
The budget for this movie is around $25 million. And the box office, it pulled in $26.1 million, right around there.
Wow, kind okay.
of made its money back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actors in this, I'm only going to mention two of them. There's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of big name actors in this, but the main ones that we're going to focus on are Tim Robbins, who really carries most of the movie. Tim Robbins in movies like Shawshank Redemption, Mystic River, Top Gun, just to name a few.
Yeah, because this was just shortly before Shawshank, like I think just a couple of years before.
And then the other actor that I want to mention is Elizabeth Pena, who's known for Rush Hour, La Bamba, and The Incredibles, just to name a couple of those. Our filming locations for this, it was filmed partially in Puerto Rico. I would assume that that's the parts where Vietnam was happening, because the rest of it was filmed in Brooklyn, and I don't think that they just filmed the Vietnam parts in Brooklyn. Maybe they did.
Maybe.
But just don't think so.
I mean, the 1990s Brooklyn was a bit different than our current day Brooklyn. So
yeah,
maybe.
A little bit different.
It was a jungle.
I would say comparable to Vietnam.
All right. So let's get into the last bit, which is our taglines. So our first one is, you can't run from your own mind.
It's not bad.
All right.
Yeah, like, while it's appropriate, I don't like it, but yeah, I mean, I guess.
All right, well, how about this next one, which is, the most frightening thing about Jacob Singer's nightmare is that he isn't dreaming.
It's not a tagline. Not a tagline. Nope.
It's a sentence.
No, not a tagline.
It is a sentence, not the movie.
If you wanted a sentence, there you go.
Sounds like an eighth grade report. You know what I mean? Like, the key takeaway for this, Miss Schneider, is that.
It's like Bruce Joel Rubin was like, oh, God, I need to come up with something. All right.
Found or something real quick.
About
in
Jacob
Vietnam, no one can
damn
hear
it.
There it is.
There it is. All right. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Jarvis, who has our plot.
So Jacob Singer is an infantryman with the 1st Air Cavalry Division deployed in Vietnam when his unit comes under attack. As Jacob's comrades are killed or wounded, some exhibit strange symptoms leading to convulsions or seizures. Jacob flees into the jungle only to be stabbed with a bayonet by an unseen assailant. Jacob awakens in a New York City subway in 1975, where we see what appears to be a tentacle protruding from a sleeping homeless person, and is nearly hit by a train with distorted faces peering from its windows. He now lives in Brooklyn with his girlfriend and fellow post office worker Jezebel, though he misses his old family and experiences visions of them, especially the youngest of his sons, Gabe, who died in an accident before the war. Jacob experiences glimpses of faceless, vibrating figures and narrowly escapes being run over by a pursuing car. Seeking reprieve, he attempts to see a psychologist at the VA, but is told there's no record of him or the doctor that he's referenced. At a party, a psychic reads Jacob's palm and tells him that he is already dead, which Jacob dismisses as a joke. After declining to dance with her, he appears to witness an enormous creature penetrating his girlfriend before collapsing on the dance floor. At home, Jacob experiences a dangerous fever, which Jezzy attempts to bring down with a painful ice bath. Jacob is briefly transported to another reality where he lives with his wife and sons, including his youngest, Gabe, who is still alive. The experience is short-lived, as he experiences more Vietnam flashbacks before his consciousness returns to the tub.
Those were certainly things that happened in the first part of this movie.
There's a lot there. Yeah. There's a lot there. Yeah. Right? They do fit a lot. It's kind of difficult to break up. So I guess let's start with the Vietnam depiction, right? Mm-hmm. When we start this movie, like, this is a first watch for me. I'm assuming it was for you guys too.
Yeah.
This is not the way I expected it. I know that this is like a wartime era movie. It's going to talk about like PTSD and other issues, you know, synonymous with war. But I didn't realize like this is how we were going to start. So what'd you guys think at the beginning?
That was pretty good. I think it was, appropriately gruesome, not overly, but obviously wartime, especially Vietnam wartime kind of carnage. New York City was interesting. It's the 90s in New York City is always a wild place.
Which do you think you'd be in more danger? 90s New York City or 1975 Vietnam? Or 1971 Vietnam?
Difficult question. they're close at times.
I think it's fun how New York in the late 80s, early 90s always looks really similar. It's like there's a download pack for late 80s, early 90s New York. Like, you just know what you're going to see. You're going to see, like,
dingy
paper going across the ground. You're going to see, like, one homeless guy just, like, looking real gruff at the people. You're going to see, like, a fence that's been torn down.
The homeless guy, it's never summertime if you see a homeless guy either. He is, like...
Yeah, it's always winter.
Right, it's always winter when they show the hobos.
Yeah. Well, their summer outfits are cuter. That's why they really want the grungy winter.
Their summer collections are just too adorable. Okay, you can't. it spins the whole direction of the movie.
You also got the metal barricades that are in front of doors. They're all graffitied on.
There's a lot of graffiti.
You know, the usual New York. Yeah, always graffiti.
It makes me think. Like, do you think that New York really was that dingy like at that time?
Probably.
Or do you think that it's like?
I still think it's that
exacerbated.
I think it's close because none of these movies were, especially during the time, I don't think they were shitting on New York City for being grunt. They weren't making a point. They weren't trying to say like New York City is hot garbage and looks disgusting. They're like, this is just New York City. Here you go.
And here we are, New York City.
We filmed in Brooklyn. What do you want?
Yeah. No, it's not like a jab. It's just like, there's a lot of fucking people here, man. Like gotta get used to this.
I did like the guy later on in the movie who, I don't know, he was watching the main character and he takes his coffee and just dumps it out the window and throws the cup. I was like, that's very New York. That's pretty good.
Fuck your coffee.
I never understood the dump the coffee and then throw the cup. Like, why not just throw the cup if you're going to throw the cup on the ground? Like, dumping the coffee is like, I don't want to litter. I'm just going to dump my coffee. But this guy's like, I want to dump my coffee and litter.
He's making a point.
It's a lot of social.
I'm the reason the city's so bad.
Yeah, I don't know. How did you feel about the Vietnam War things, Jarvis?
I thought it was actually a really tasteful look at it. It was real. Like the dialogue was very real. It didn't seem like diminishing as representation was, because like the Vietnam War era, like there's actually like a lot of similarities between like the Vietnam era and like the global war on terrorism era. And I think this was like a very appropriate way to kind of show like what that camaraderie would look like between the guys. It didn't feel pandering. And the violence of action actually seemed pretty appropriate. Because if you actually, so fun story, the average soldier in World War II only saw in a given year about 20 some odd days of combat. The average Vietnamese era soldier saw somewhere in the range of 200s. That's an actual statistic out of a year. So it's not like, it's not ridiculous to say like an onslaught, like an attack like that would occur in the beginning. Obviously, this is before we kind of know what's going on. But I thought, honestly, I thought it was really good. But I was so confused what was going on when they started convulsing. Mm-hmm. I was like, what is this strychnine? What is this? You kind of get the feeling it's some sort of experimental drug in the food supply.
At the very least, a poison.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that scene set the movie up pretty well, though, for the tone. Because, like, I had no idea what I was going into. And seeing something like that, like a realistic wartime kind of situation, just like really sets you up like, all right, so this is the vibe that we're going for in this movie. And it kind of like puts you on the right path.
I think it's just past the time period when I guess media was starting to come back around and understand that Vietnam War vets had it pretty fucking bad.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously we get it now and we're a little bit more aware of it. But it, like the 80s was a time period of like, you're terrible for coming back from war. Good job. Thanks for fighting in a war.
Yeah.
You know, like it. Yeah.
No, yeah, there was no clapping in the airport terminals for these guys.
No.
When it comes to the rest of this, really the rest of this movie until we get to the very end, I struggle to like really have opinions because I just think that the movie has so many, without jumping to the end, there's just like different interpretations that you could take of this, which adds more strength or less strength to like a conversation being had. And I feel I land in one camp where I don't know. It just felt like a lot of fillers happening. Understandable filler.
Okay.
But not, I don't know.
So like, yeah, when we get to the end, we can, I like what you said though. Like, I think this is conversation sparking, right? Because there's a lot of different ways that things can be interpreted.
Yeah.
And I like movies like that. But getting back to important things like New York hobos, did you guys not see the mythical Chupacabra hobo on the subway? That was pretty fucking cool.
No, I did not see that.
See his little fucking tail?
Yeah, he had a cute little tail.
A little wriggly tail there. I was like, that's the mythical New York City subway Chupacabra hobo.
That's pretty typical, honestly. Pretty typical. Somebody who rides a subway pretty often, yeah.
So it's really not that great of a sighting.
People think that, like, Pizza Rat is mythical. it's the same thing. You see them all. You see one, you see 100.
Oh, God, seeing 100 Pizza Rats.
The scene with the demon sex pit. My new band name.
Great band name.
Little sexy, little concerning.
Yeah, you're a little confused by it, right?
Little confused in a lot of ways.
You rewind it like 6 times to be, you got to be sure.
Yeah, at least 6 times. You got to make sure you see what's going on there. I don't know. Like, I wasn't scared at any of these things, though. Like, I just kind of was like, all right. See, a lot of this just felt like a fever dream, which, again, goes back to the end. I'm going to feel like good about that idea. But, like, watching it, because it was my first time, it just felt like a fever dream. And I was like, I didn't feel invested in what was happening because I was like, I get the point. I don't know what's happening, like what's real, what's not. But that makes me not care as much. Like, I needed a little more grounding in reality for me to really have any like feeling for the movie. And I just didn't have it at this point.
That's fair. I think the thing that did help me with that was I actually appreciated the relationship with Jezebel and Jacob. Like, I think their relationship was fairly reasonable and decent. And I think they had a fun back and forth. I think that was just really well acted in general. Yeah, I so I appreciated that. That helps kind of ground it a bit. And you see your boobies. I don't know. It helps.
Holy shit, dude. That shirt had been teasing me for like 3 hours. I wrote down a nude clock. I think it's, but I didn't even write down a real one. Cause I was cheering in the air. Like, finally, when we see a boob, but it's around the 17 mark. When that goddamn,
I was gonna say it's pretty early. What do you
dude? That it's a plunging V of a shirt unbuttoned, and it just teases you for like 30 years.
It's like stuck,
right?
It's stuck, and she's like, "Let me just and then yeah, it did.
It's like her nipples had Velcro on them. Like that shirt did not move.
That sounds so uncomfortable.
Yes,
I wasn't sure. Like Tim Robbins, you know, just visually, he doesn't look like the guy who would land like a hot New York Latina girlfriend. But I mean, she certainly does make it a way of making all of his problems about her.
I don't disagree that it doesn't look like he can pull, but at the same time, I think this is the time period where he's, maybe it is, he comes across the group of women and they sing Mr. Postman to him.
Oh yeah.
And they're like, do a spin. There was a good scene. So apparently he can get
He's pretty tall. So he's like 6'5", man.
Yeah, he's very tall.
But Jesse's like, "Do you still love me? Do you still love me?" When he's talking about demons, I'm like, "Can one thing in this man's life be about him?" She gets all weird when he's talking about his dead kid.
Yes,
you know,
I didn't like that about her. So, I thought that was a bad. Yeah, go ahead.
So one interpretation is that I think there's a lot of like biblical shit that goes into this movie that I didn't really delve into. I just kind of looked like surface level, like different opinions and things like that. And I think she's supposed to symbolize like some sort of demon who's like trying to tear him apart from like his memories and like,
because
she burns the pictures of his family. She,
wow. Yeah.
So there's like other things in there. Like the sex pit has to do with it. I've seen people cite the part where she's like forcing him into the tub and like hurting him, even though he's saying, "I feel fine." And like, that's hurting him. I think that there's like, a lot of symbolism that goes into this that I'm really didn't catch because I've only seen it once, but you know, take that, put that in your hat or don't.
There's so many biblical references throughout this movie. This whole thing really is kind of like that homage, that motif. That's a good catch though, because like, there really are so many. I kind of forgot about the burning. You know that she's a demon because of like the way that she's like guiding him away from like prosperity, like with his family. But you know, because we're kind of stuck in this like strange limbo, this whole thing, by the way, is just his ascension of the biblical ladder of Jacob's ladder. There you go, there's the thing, right? From hell to purgatory to heaven. And these three parts slowly, you know, progress to get us there. And good Lord, if he wasn't dead already, 106 degree internal temp, my dude, his thinking meat is a roasting. That mm-hmm. is really fucking hot for the inside of your body to be.
Boiled boy. Yeah.
You know what we would do in the field if that happened to a dude? You know what happens? This is an honest question. Do you know what happens? Like if you're out in the hot and you start getting like a really high internal temp, what you're supposed to do?
Heroin.
Piss on.
They shove an ice rod up your asshole.
That makes a lot of sense.
Where do you get it?
Actually.
Yeah, I'm dead serious.
Where do you get it?
No, they make those. It is medicinal.
But where can I get one?
Yeah, no, I'll send you guys a link.
So,
army surplus.
And by the way, that thing has like psychotropic properties, right? Because like your mind is literally cooking, and you're like, you know, forcing it the other way with the core temp, you know, is now going to lower now that you have ice in your asshole. And I just want to know
they come immediately,
right? Yeah. Obviously, you're gonna come immediately. I want to know what's better, right? That the fucking ice rod up the pooper,
or just a bad dragon,
or a bad dragon, which we know. And that guy on the
side probably
answer. Could tell you because that
and that brings us to our sponsor of today's
episode. Use code horrible friend
and watch as nothing happens.
But we appreciate it anyway. But which drug is better, the ice rod up the poop chute or the 80s acid? Because it just looks like it just hits differently, man. That party,
yeah.
Holy shit! I can safely say that no drug that I've ever taken has made me see like a rotting pterodactyl, like ass fucking my demon girlfriend on a disco, like to the background of a disco track. You know what I mean?
It's fair. I mean, especially if it's the same stuff that they were giving out during the Vietnam War, apparently. It's good stuff.
So, last thing I will say before we move on. Did not expect Macaulay Culkin in this movie.
No. Well,
He was uncredited. He wasn't credited in the movie.
I thought he was supposed to be at home.
Alone.
I think this was actually a little before Home Alone.
Yeah, this is like a year or two before, I think.
Yeah, I think it was something with his dad, who is his agent. Yeah, mm-hmm. There was like some problem between the studio and Macaulay Culkin, so he just didn't get credited.
Which is absolutely insane, because I had read about that.
This is the same year, Home Alone and Jacob's Ladder, both 1990.
So, yeah, I read about that, and like the fact that he was uncredited, I thought his likeness was used just for like a picture. So I was like, oh, that kind of sucks, but like he wasn't a big name yet. But no, he is like, he's a major role in this film. That is awful, man.
Yeah, that's really weird. Very unexpected, again, especially with like Home Alone coming out very shortly after. Like, it's strange. I mean, who knows what child stars are always a mystery, especially back in the day. There's a lot of controversy, obviously, with their existence and whatnot, with most of them being a little inundated in the system a little too early, I think. But yeah, it's
Jacob's rough. Ladder came out just about like 2 weeks before Home Alone came out.
Whoa.
Yeah, Jacob's Ladder came out November 2nd of 90 and Home Alone came out November 16th.
This kid really did blow up overnight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one thing to be like really popular in a movie. You got like back-to-back films that were like pretty big pieces of film in their time. Okay, moving on to part 2. One of Jacob's former platoon mates, Paul, contacts him to reveal that he is suffering from similar experiences, but is soon killed afterwards when his car explodes. Commiserating after the funeral, other surviving members of the platoon confess they've all been experiencing horrifying hallucinations, believing that they too are suffering the effects of a military experiment performed on them without their knowledge or consent. They hire a lawyer to investigate. However, the lawyer quits the case after reading military files documenting that the soldiers were never in combat and were discharged for psychological purposes. Jacob's comrades soon back down while Jacob suspects that they've been threatened into doing so. Jacob is then abducted by suited men who try to intimidate him, but Jacob fights them off and escapes, but is injured in the process. He is taken to a nightmarish hospital where he is told that he has been killed and this is home, but his chiropractor friend Lewis comes to his rescue and heals him. Lewis quotes the 14th century Christian mystic Meister Eckhart and says, "The only thing that burns in hell is the part of you that won't let go."
So this is the part where I really got sucked in, because like, I don't know, like this part of the story was way more interesting than the beginning. And I would argue that outside of the Vietnam part in the beginning, I wish that we could have like flipped it so that, you know, maybe like his relationship was established during this, while this was going on. It just feels like this is like a more concrete part that gave me that grounding that I needed to be like, okay, this is probably reality. Like, my brain was like, okay, I could, like, stick with this. And then, like, the fuzzle fuckery that goes along with, like, trying to fuck up our heads.
Sure, yeah. The body horror and, like, the actual, like, the camera work and the effects, they pick up a notch during this portion of the film. Mm-hmm, because yeah. You're not sure. Watching the beginning part, you're like, part one, like, you get the sense towards the end that this is concretely a horror movie. But in the beginning, like, you're like, is this a Vietnam era movie? And then it could be a drama. And then there's like these weird little flashes of like amorphous faces, you know, these body deformities. And you're not sure if this is just post-traumatic stress. And, you know, how does that play in? But part two of this movie, the centerpiece, really does pick up the horror elements. The hospital, for sure.
Yeah, I didn't expect. I mean, I'm following this movie along like it's actually happening to this guy. And then he goes to the hospital, fair enough, after he jumps out of a car and gets kind of beaten up and everything like that. And Santa Claus steals his wallet, which is...
Oh, yeah, what the fuck? Yeah. where is that in the biblical semblance, you know? Where is the simile there?
That's a New York Santa right there.
That is a... what is it? Praying to a false god? Santa Claus,
that's what it is.
Or some little kid asked for that guy's wallet.
So that's it's fair. Like,
all right, I gotta go beat his ass and get the wallet.
This whole movie is
I want Jacob Singer's wallet.
This whole movie is an affront towards the Sears catalog. That's all it is.
At this point in the movie, I started to feel like, because I didn't know what the twist was, I started to feel like this was all the best representation that I could probably have, and the best understanding that I could have of someone who has schizophrenia. Like, I was like, oh, this is just a movie about like this guy who's schizophrenic and this is his paranoia going on, and it's like him developing schizophrenia slowly. So like, that's kind of where my brain was going with it, and I liked that idea until the very end, and I saw what the twist was, and I was like, oh, I was way off. But like, at this point, I'm just like, holy shit, the Santa thing, like, yo, that's why fucking schizophrenic people sometimes hate Santa. That's fucking why. Like,
because they all have Santa Claus stealing their wallets. Yeah, it's really weird. It's a common symptom. Yeah. I thought this, again, I thought it did start getting a little creepy, and then going down the hallways into the deep, dark dungeons of a random hospital, and then this battle.
It was a typical New York hospital, though, right? That's what I thought.
Yeah.
It was an 80s,
yeah,
90s.
Glass all over the floor.
Hospital,
yeah.
In New York. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and it gets creepy, and then he gets the drill to the head, which I thought was pretty good.
Holy
and,
shit, man. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of good scenes in this part.
To me, the horror, I didn't think anything like the body horror and all that kind of stuff, that didn't like really phase me. The part that was phasing me was this delve into insanity. And like, I think it's just like no one believing you. And like that kind of fear is like really something that's genuinely scary and something that we could all somewhat relate to on like a very minute level of like people not listening to you. And so like, that was like kind of fucking me up while I was watching it.
Yeah. And I think I was trying to stay away from like delving too deep into that direction, especially because it's kind of a, I don't know if it's a stereotypical trope, but it's some sort of trope, I think, usually, especially with PTSD folks are suddenly just going, you know, crazy and having immediate, you know, breakdowns and willing to fight people and not knowing who's what, like that. That's not like a, I don't think it's a usual sign of PTSD, but it is portrayed that way fairly often, I think.
It is, yeah. It can be used as kind of a cheap story mechanism, for sure.
All right, which I think is what this movie kind of pivots you. You're bouncing in different directions. It's like, what is the big bad guy here? Is it PTSD? Are they making a point about it? Or is it schizophrenia, like Dan's saying? Is it some sort of other actual mental issue? Is he actually being attacked by people? Are there demons in this one? Like, what direction? Because we just don't know. The whole movie, you're just like, what are the rules in this movie? We don't know what the bad guy is, besides the U.S. government. We always know it's the U.S. government's bad
fucking
guy. But anyway.
Right. I like that it's worlds colliding, though, right? Not just in what is actually happening to Jacob, but in what the audience sees, right? Because there's a lot of different ways that you can interpret it. It really is worlds colliding in that I don't think it was a cheap depiction of post-traumatic stress. I think the thing that movies get wrong is that they become victims, right? They become like cowering in a corner, and that's not usually how the depiction should be. I think Jacob is still very much in control. He's confused, he's nervous, but he still has kind of like, you know, his own path that he is taking. He's still the guy in control. The other thing we haven't really talked about here is that Jacob, though he was like a private in the infantry during Vietnam, this man has a PhD. Like he is Dr. Singer.
Fair.
Which was the other element that we haven't discussed. Like, I actually wasn't sure if the idea that this is all, you know, because of like some sort of psychotropic drug that he took in Vietnam, I was wondering, is it affecting Jacob this way, the way that the audience sees? Is it affecting him differently because his brain is so much more developed than that of his comrades?
Hmm. Could be. But we also don't know what his comrades are. They could all be PhDs. They could all have PhDs. We don't
just
know.
The whole infantry unit of PhDs.
Hey, I mean,
and now send the doctors in.
Back to the hospital. I, watching this, because I truly think this is probably the best part in the whole movie, both in terms of the horror and just like the suspense. I was wondering to myself, I was really thinking, I was like, is this the most realistic depiction of hell that I've ever seen on film?
Just the hospital.
The hospital, room. Right? The descent the entire way down, right? Yeah. The carnage kind of building there. And then it's the idea that he's like stuck in this hell, right? And the people that he is trusting, because Jesse's like one of the evil doctors. And then the anti-cyclops just goes ahead and like pokes him full of holes.
The non-clops.
Thank you. Oh, I couldn't think of a good one. Non-clops is good.
I was gonna say, is an anti-cyclops just someone with two eyes? That's just a normal
Are
person.
We anti-cyclops?
I historically and well known, I am anti-cyclops. That's
wow, man, pretty fucked up of you.
Well,
I'm not really sure.
Okay, I guess we didn't all know that. I knew that.
Yeah, gotta have a stance.
Oh, so you're in support of this, huh?
Oh, okay.
Look.
Beowulf was the bad guy. Okay, we all know that.
Free Beowulf. One thing from this, it's love thy neighbor, and I love Kyle despite his prejudices. So there you go.
That's totally fair. No, I thought this was a great scene. It is a very interesting, especially once the heaven hell combating each other mindset starts to kind of come in to this movie at about this point where things start getting a little wacky. You start to realize, I thought that the guy asking the questions during that time period, like, where are you? And I think that's, we're gonna talk about it later. I think that with the twist in mind, it makes a lot more sense of somebody going, where are you? How are you? What's wrong with you? What are you doing? It's potentially somebody on a bedside asking him these questions. He's going through some tough stuff later on in the movie, right? Like, it's interesting.
Beautifully said. The last thing to talk about here is that we kind of see the flashback of Macaulay Culkin's character, his youngest son, Gabe, how he died, and crossing the street with his bike, and he drops the baseball cards. Did you guys see that baseball card that he dropped?
I did. Is it good?
Let's talk about Rich Gossage. Rich Gossage's stats, incredible. Okay, now here's the thing. This kid was smart. This would have been maybe 72 or 73 when Rich Gossage was a rookie. Let me tell you something about Rich Gossage. He is in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, okay? And this kid knew that baseball card was worth something back in 72 or 73 when he had an ERA of 4.28. This guy had a lifetime ERA by 1994 of 3.01. That is insane.
Yeah, you definitely said numbers.
So that's good.
Yeah.
Baseball. Huh.
And
you a Yankees fan now? That's all I'm hearing. Let it be known that Jarvis is a Yankees fan.
That is the dumbest thing that could ever be.
I mean, yeah, this kid, obviously smart kid because he had this thing, but he did dump it right on the ground and get hit by a car. So not so smart now, is he?
Not very smart. Not honestly, very smart, no. Not very smart.
Had he could have just stayed comatose for 40 years, that card right now, worth a couple $100s. Could have helped with some medical bills. Not a lot of them, but some of them.
It could have, you know, paid for like a needle.
A Tylenol.
A Tylenol. Yeah. Not extra strength now. No.
We're going.
No.
Yeah, maybe some Bayer aspirin. One.
Yeah, no. That's Bayer. Name brand. We're going Bayheart.
Aspirin. Yeah, Bayheart. No, great value.
It just says acetaminophen.
It's just
yeah. So moving on to part three, our third and final part. Jacob is approached by a distressed man who had been following him from a distance and who also helped drag him away from Paul's burning car. Introducing himself as Michael Newman, he tells a story about having been a chemist for the Army's Chemical Warfare Division, in which he designed a drug he called the Ladder, which targets massively increased aggression in soldiers. Michael claims that to test the drug's effectiveness, a dose was secretly given to Jacob's unit before the battle, causing some of them to turn on each other in a homicidal frenzy. Michael's story triggers a vision of Jacob wounded in Vietnam, which shows his attacker as a fellow American soldier. Jacob returns to his family's home, where he finds Gabe, who takes him by the hand and leads him up the staircase into a bright light. The scene then turns to a triage tent in 1971 as military doctors declare Jacob is dead. The doctor takes one of his dog tags off of his body and notes that Jacob had put up a tremendous fight to stay alive, but looked peaceful in his death.
So yeah, this is where the movie all comes together, right? Like, this is where it all kind of makes sense to me. So this is where you can take different views of this movie and what we're doing. My view, and I'm still kind of thinking about it after it's been like a day since I've watched it now, I think this was all just kind of purgatory, right? Mm-hmm. And like, he's just seeing all these weird visions that don't make any sense. He was just killed by like someone in Vietnam, like not one of his soldiers, nothing like that. It was just war. And they tried to save him, and he's just going through these fever dream images. And unfortunately, he just doesn't come out of it.
So you're saying he made up this story?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is made up, but I think that some of it has to do with regrets of not finding, what's the right word? Not finding like closure in his life. Sure. So his son is hit by a car, and then he goes to war. He never gets to come home and see his wife again, or his ex-wife, and like make that right. Like, that was just never right for him. So he harps on that in his dreams. He has guilt about dying, and I don't know, I'm still kind of piecing it all together, but I think a lot of this has to do with like not concluded business, and like it's just his brain processing all this as it's deteriorating and dying.
I think that's certainly one lens. I think another is that kind of what Kyle said, he's getting like these external voices, right? Because some of the dialogue is almost out of place in some of the scenes where it's like, where are you? Do you know where you are? And which makes sense, right? Because he's on a triage table. So that makes sense. Right. Juxtapose that, right? Let's marry that with the idea that this all has like this biblical sense, and like a story like Dante's Inferno is all about like the descent, the descent first, and then the ascent, which I think plays into the imagery really well. So I think some of what you could infer is either like he's making this story up because he obviously wouldn't know these things, or he would find fellow people in purgatory to like come to the conclusion that this was all actually what happened. And I think, and I like that it's left open ended.
Yeah. And I think the whole ride at the end of the movie, getting towards the end, is interesting. It's if you have that theory where he's meeting other actual people who are sitting in a purgatory thing, you've got the taxi driver, right, who's like, no, I get lost on the way to Brooklyn. And apparently Brooklyn is heaven, by the way, but you got to take the taxi cab to Brooklyn. And then, so the guy's like, I get lost. And he's like, no, it's okay, I know the way. And I thought that was, you know, that's some allegory to something religious. And then you've got somebody guarding the gates to get into his house. You've got the literal doorman that's preventing him from getting into and then opening the gates for him into his house. And he even says, oh, it's been a while since you've been here. Well, yeah, grace. It was, you know, divorce, whatever.
It took him a while to get to grace. And that's right. The simile between those two elements. Right, and then the taxi cab is the ferryman that we've discussed before, kind of like over the river Styx.
Getting them to the across the way. Yeah. And then I think there are some people out on the internets there you can find pretty easily. I think a good thing was mentioned that I don't disagree with at the moment. I'm still kind of taking it in. I don't know if the ending was good for me. I think there was a lot that you could infer for a long time about what was happening, what wasn't happening. And then they cut to him dying in Vietnam, and that's just how it is, right? Like, the end of the movie just takes you, it takes you to this whole like we said, all these allegories about the Bible and fighting and all this other stuff and about what's going on in his head, and then it just goes, well, he's still in Vietnam, he's dead, and just cuts. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's kind of there's a lot of emotion that's built up to a certain point, and then they just kind of, instead of letting you feel the end emotion, they just tell you how the movie ends, which is meh.
Did it feel dull to you? Like it wasn't a sharp pain?
Yeah.
You
know what I mean? Yeah, it just kind of ended. I don't know. I think I wanted more of an internal inflection from the end of this, because that's all they were doing the whole movie, was just, how do you feel about this? You know, talking about all these pieces and then just telling you, well, he did die. So I guess you could take it as, like you said, he was happier now that he fought his demons, literally.
So when I watched it, I got to like the perfect level of high, because pretty early on in the movie, I was like, this guy's dead, isn't he? I don't know. Just keep going.
Clairvoyant high.
Yeah. I was like, I think he's dead.
Sounds like you ascended the ladder, my friend.
I apparently ascended the ladder, and the only rungs I had were Girl Scout cookies. Huh. And
really bad to get there.
Worst ways to be in purgatory, pal.
Yeah. It was rough. But I persevered and I got through.
Well, if that doesn't go ahead and take us over to our final bit here, we're going to talk about the spoopy meter. Dan, what kind of spoopy levels we got?
You know, a movie like this, it's hard to like come up with something real like goofy. So I just wanted to keep it like nice and serious. So I'm really glad that you weren't the only one who recognized that baseball card of Rich Gossage, because mm-hmm. I recognized it too. So good old Goose. You know, Goose played for 22 years, which is, you know, on average, that's like about 11 years longer than most pitchers will pitch.
Indeed.
So, guys, over that span, he played 1,002 games. So, you know, if this was the Goose, this movie was the Goose, how many games are you going to see? 0 to 1,002.
1,002. This movie was not scary, I guess. There was no, I don't know. The true scary meter, I'm at like a 2. I'll be nice. Give it a 2. It's fine. I thought it was a pretty decent movie. I would say I would show up to 567 games, baby. Just over the mark.
Yeah, no, definitely not scary. I also give it 2 games. I think the only thing that really kind of, at least I think it was more just surprise and less of a scare, was like that little neck crack like early on. Like,
oh,
just
God,
the sudden thing of that like kind of made me jump a little bit, but that's about it. Everything else is just kind of like, what the fuck is that? But overall, I think I'll do 669. You know, it was a fun movie. It was very interesting, and I liked that I had to actually sit and ponder and think about it at the end. So yeah, 669.
Beautiful. Chiropractors, by the way, really are angels. Incredible. Incredible what they can do. I actually did find this movie pretty terrifying, not in the sense that like the imagery was scary, but it does make you ponder. It kind of is one of those movies that causes you to self-reflect. So the idea of dementia mixed with any sort of spicy sad like is absolutely terrifying to me. So I will overall, I'm going to say about 700 and just leave it there.
Yeah, the ending kind of fucked me up a little bit. But like it wasn't scary. I mean, just the idea of like grappling with death, I think, is like freaky. So just for that, it was like pretty creepy. And I respect all the metaphors and different things that I didn't look into all that much. But I appreciate a movie where you can look into it a lot more. So yeah, I will go to 0 games because I don't like baseball, and I'll go watch hockey instead.
Well, with that, appreciate everybody listening in. I do want to thank Andrew Kavanaugh for our good old music. I want to thank Jarvis for doing all the editing. I want to thank true baseball fans out there, because it is the worst sport. And I do
dude, fuck all of you, fuck this podcast. Fuck this, I'm out.
Chris, what do you say to all the baseball fans out there?
Thanks for stopping by and having a horrible time.
And they always will. It's a boring game.
Yeah, it's horrible and boring.
Do something interesting.
I'm gonna hurry up
and fuck you guys. Rich Gossage is an amazing individual. Let's talk about it.